God morgon. Hör ni mig? Okej, ni hör mig bra. Jag ska sänka rösten lite grann då. Vi har ljudinspelning här i salen. Det är bra att alla vet. Jag vill gärna be alla som har frågor att vänta tills ni får en mikrofon. Så att vi får det jättefint upp på tape. Jag heter Danny Arts. Jag är vd för .se. Välkommen till 9:e omgång av internetdagar. Vi organiserar internetdagar varje år som en stor mötesplats för alla som jobbar professionellt med internet. Nu är så småningom alla med på internet här i Sverige, om man får tro på statistik. Ändå tror jag att vårt liv med internet har precis börjat. Nu är vi uppkopplade, men jag tror om några år är kanske våra skor uppkopplade också, eller våra glasögon, eller alla våra ting som vi har hemma. Det kan låta skrämmande, men det är, tror jag, det som kommer att hända. Kanske om några år ligger vår hela identitet också på internet. Så hur ska vi handskas med det? Jag tänkte inte prata så länge. Vi har tre jätteintressanta talare som vi öppnar internetdagarna med. Vi har Finn Surf som varit med från början, som kommer att berätta mer om vad han tror kommer att hända framåt. Vi har Åsa Torstensson som kommer att berätta om statens syn på utvecklingen av internet och hur vi kan främja det. Och vi har Jeff Houston som ser ut som Patrik Fällström. Jeff är sjuk, så Patrik hjälper oss och gör en kombination av en egen presentation och Jeff Houstons presentation som handlar väldigt mycket om IPv6. Det som vi tror kommer att behövas om vi ska ha alla våra skor ut på internet också. Jag tänkte börja med Mr. Finn Surf. Welcome to Sweden, to sunny Sweden, and
yes, thank you. Jag talar inte svenska, so we have to put up with English, and also we have to figure out how to find my presentation, which is here, I think. And even though I normally use a Macintosh, I'm struggling with this PC. You know, you have to accommodate sometimes. Whoops. All right. So, this morning, I'm going to try to give you some idea of a little bit of the history of where the network came from, but mostly I want to focus on what's happening today and what we can expect to happen in the future with the internet. This group of people, I understand, keep meeting every year, and I understand that the group gets bigger and bigger every year. Sweden has been for a long time at the forefront of the use of internet in Europe. You've been the most penetrated population. So one of the reasons that I enjoy coming back over and over again is to see what else you have figured out to do using the network. But let's go back in time for a moment to almost 40 years ago, when the predecessor to the internet, called the ARPANET, was an experiment to see if packet switching would work at all. And there were only four computers in the first network design. And I was responsible for writing the software of a machine called the Sigma 7, down in the lower right there, to connect to the first packet switch on the ARPANET installed at UCLA. And the Sigma 7 is now in a museum somewhere, and every once in a while people say, well, maybe you should be in the museum along with it. But here I am. This is what the packet switch looked like. It was the size of a refrigerator, and it was delivered in a very heavy metal container. The company that built these, called Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They still are. And they were delivering this on a military contract, and they weren't quite sure what the military would do with it, so they put it in this heavy metal container with screw eyes on the top in case they needed to lower it by helicopter to some hostile environment. It ended up at UCLA, surrounded by graduate students, And that's a very hostile environment, so it's a good thing that it was built that way. A few years later, we began to experiment with connecting different kinds of packet switch nets to each other. We had mobile radio networks. We had a satellite network, which had a ground station in Tanum, Sweden, and the wireline internet, ARPANET. And so connecting all of them together using the new, at that time, the new TCP/IP protocols was a very important milestone. So 30 years ago, we did the first testing linking all three of the nets to each other. And much to our my amazement, it actually worked. This particular test was interesting because the packets were being transmitted from a mobile radio, the little van that you see in the left, driving up and down the street in San Francisco or the San Francisco Bay Area. It was transmitting data south to a machine at University of Southern California Information Sciences Institute in Marina Del Rey, about 400 miles to the south. But the way the packet was routed through the network, it went from the radio network into the ARPANET all the way across not only the United States, but through an internal satellite hop to Norway and then down by landline to London, then through another gateway through the packet satellite network and again through another synchronous satellite hop back to the United States, back into the ARPANET and all the way down to Marina Del Rey. So if you actually calculated how far did each packet go, it was over 100,000 miles. And I remember when it worked, you know, we were all leaping around saying, it works, it works. If you know anything about software, it's a miracle whenever any of it works. So we were pretty excited about that. So this was a big milestone 30 years ago. And if we fast forward to 1999, the internet got much bigger. This is a topological picture of the internet prepared with some software by Bill Cheswick, who was at Belcore at the time, which models the network based on the routing tables, the global routing tables. So each color is a different network. And this is showing how those networks are interconnected with each other. And you really can't tell very much from pictures like this, except that the network got a lot bigger, and it got more connected, and it got more colorful. And that's a pretty good definition of what the internet is. Well, today, if we're looking at the network from the outside, what we see is about over a half billion computers on the network. Now, that's not all the computers that are on the net. That's just the ones that are visible publicly. And as time has gone on, the internet has evolved, and more of the equipment that's on the internet is actually hiding behind firewalls. So the real population of computers on the network is not reflected by this number. This is a lower bound. It also doesn't take into account things that are connected from time to time, like laptops, which may be episodically connected, or mobiles now, which are connected from time to time to the internet. Those are not in the data. So the real number of devices that are on the internet is probably in excess of a billion. The number of people on the internet has reached 1.5 billion, which is about 22% of the world's population. Another thing which has been happening in the last decade is while the internet has been growing, so has the mobile telephone network. There are estimated to be 3.5 billion mobiles in use today around the world. And so that, too, has become a very important part of the internet's environment because about 15% of the mobiles are internet-enabled. And so they are becoming an increasingly important part of the internet because for a lot of people, the first time they interact with the internet won't be with a laptop, it will be with a mobile. So those of us like Google and others who are trying to offer new services to internet users have to start concentrating on how to deliver those services through mobiles as well as through conventional laptops and desktops. The distribution of the users of the internet has also changed dramatically in the last decade. And in particular, Asia has become the largest regional user of internet services. China alone has about 250 million users on the network. The United States only has about 238 million. So there are more Chinese on the net than there are Americans, which is something of a surprise for many Americans who think of the internet as being a kind of an American thing. By the way, that isn't true either. Although Bob Kahn and I did the original design in 1973, when we started doing the detailed design in my laboratory at Stanford University, I had help from people all over the world. I had scientists coming from Europe, from Norway, from France, from England, from Japan. So it was very much an international effort, even from the earliest days. I also would like to note that Europe is the second largest regional grouping on the network, but I have completely given up making any predictions about Europe because you keep adding countries. And so I have no way of knowing what's Europe anymore, so I give up. The rest of the numbers are as you see them. Africa continues to be the most difficult part of the Internet to grow. Part of the reason is that the African economies are varied, dramatically varied in their strength and scale. And also the telecom infrastructure in Africa is generally immature. But every capital in Africa has Internet access. Often it's found in the universities first or in Internet cafes, so the cost can be shared on an hour-by-hour basis. The rate of growth of the net from the point of view of hosts on the net has continued to be quite healthy. It's not growing at 100% a year as it once was, or if it is, we can't quite tell because the growth is hiding behind the firewalls. But it's growing fast enough that we are running out of the address space that was originally chosen in 1977 for the experiment. Now, it's my fault that we have a 32-bit address space on the Internet. And my only defense is that that decision was made in 1977 at a time when this was it was uncertain whether or not the Internet would actually work. There were debates for over a year about how big the address space should be, and the engineers couldn't agree. Some wanted variable length, some wanted 128-bit address, and some people wanted 32. And the variable length was discarded immediately because the programmers hated the idea of having to calculate where the fields of the packet were. It would waste a lot of CPU power. So that went away immediately. 128-bit address space in 1977 seemed excessive. If you do the math, it's 340 trillion, trillion, trillion addresses. And I couldn't imagine any argument that would require that much address space for an experiment. So we went with 32 bits, 4.3 billion addresses, which should be enough for the military to figure out whether this technology would work. The problem is the experiment didn't end. And so here we are in 2008, we're running out. This chart, which is made by Jeff Houston a year or so ago, has an important line is the one that's going down. That's the one that says how much of the IPv4 address space is going to be available to be allocated by the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority at ICANN, and the estimate is that it will be exhausted around the middle of 2010. So it's important for us to move to IPv6 now, which does have 128-bit address space. This packet format was standardized around 1996, and it's slowly entering into the network, but people haven't felt very much pressure up until now to implement it. Now, the deadline is coming when we won't have any more IPv4 address space to hand out, and it's becoming more apparent to many people that it's time to start implementing both of them in parallel, V4 and V6. In addition to having a much larger address space so we can continue to grow the Internet, there are other features about this particular protocol which are attractive. One of them is that if the other side says, I need to go into secure mode, encrypted mode, you're supposed to comply with that. It's optional in IPv4. And there are some other features like a flow ID that's part of the structure of the packet that allows you to do things with connectionless kinds of applications that you couldn't do with the IPv4 structure. I'm really proud to tell you that Google has taken up this responsibility. We've implemented ipv6.google.com, and if you go there on an IPv6 network, you'll see an animated Google logo because that's how you can tell if you've gotten there by IPv6 instead of the traditional IPv4. There are some problems implementing this, and although I don't think I have time to go into any detail, I do want to say that running two protocols at the same time in the Internet is harder than running one only one. For one thing, you have two routing tables, and you have two routing activities going on concurrently. The two don't interwork with each other, and so if a V6 user and a V4 user want to talk to each other and they don't happen to have dual mode, then you have to go through some kind of translation to permit the connectivity to happen. The network management tools for IPv6 are not as mature as the ones for V4 because they're just getting started. So there really needs to be some experience with running this dual mode system. I want to come back to mobiles for a few minutes. I mentioned there are estimated to be 3.5 billion of them in use. What's important about the mobiles is that they're not just telephones. They're clearly programmable devices. Google, in fact, gets very excited about the fact that they're programmable devices. We recently released an operating system we call Android, which is intended for mobile use. In the next day or so, T-Mobile will be releasing something called the G1, which is an Android-based mobile using this open operating system. Our purpose, frankly, is to encourage more applications to be installed on mobiles. Already today, people use the mobile for texting, for access to web search or other kinds of web applications, or making payments. And Google would simply like to encourage innovation in the use of mobiles in the belief that more and more people will have those devices before they have laptops, and therefore it would enhance everyone's ability to use the Internet if they had an open platform for implementing software. Another thing which we observe about people who use mobiles is that if you treat this mobile as an information window which you carry around on your hip or in your purse, that the kinds of questions that you ask of the search engine at Google tend to have a geographic element to it. People ask about things that are going on around nearby. So they might say, where is the nearest restaurant, or where is the nearest ATM machine, where is the nearest petrol station? Those are questions that can only be answered if you know where you were at the time that you were asking the question. And so what we're seeing is that people are interested in information that's geographically indexed. Now, I had appreciated this point sort of intellectually, but I didn't really appreciate it viscerally until my family went on a holiday last year in Arizona, one of the states in the Southwest. In particular, we went to a place called Lake Powell, and we planned to rent a houseboat and go out on the lake and spend a few days. And as we were driving into a small town of Page, Arizona, somebody said, well, you know, we're going to have to buy food before we get on the boat because there are no grocery stores out on the lake. So the conversation turned to what kind of meals would we make, and someone said, why don't we make paella? And I thought, gee, that's a wonderful idea, but we need saffron to make that. Where are we going to find saffron in this little town of Page, Arizona? Well, by good fortune, I had a strong data signal, and I got my BlackBerry out, and I went to the Google web page, and I typed saffron Page, Arizona grocery store. And I got back three different choices of grocery stores with telephone numbers and little maps showing how to get there. So I clicked on the telephone number. The phone rang, a voice answered, and I said, may I speak to the spice department, please? Now, it's probably a tiny little store, and it's probably the owner of the store. Right? This is the spice department. And I said, do you have any saffron? And he said, well, I don't know, but I'll check. And he came back, and he says, yes, we have some. So we followed the map, and I ran into the store, and I bought $12.99 worth of saffron, which is 0.06 ounces, in case you care. And we made a nice paella when we got on the boat. I remember as I walked out of the store thinking, what had I just done? In real time, while we're driving around into this town, I got the information I needed to find out what store had saffron and how to get there. I didn't get the answer back, oh, you can get saffron in New York City. That's 1,200 miles away. So I came away with a sense that having geographically indexed information was really valuable. And in fact, I'm going to predict that the Internet, which here in Europe, you hear the term Internet for everyone. I really strongly believe everyone should be on the net, even though, you know, only 20% of the world's population is so far. But I think Internet is also going to be for everything. I think we're going to see a wide range of devices showing up on the network. Things like refrigerators or picture frames or things that look like telephones, but they're actually voice over IP computers. But the one that I think is the most interesting is this internet-enabled surfboard. There's a young man in San Diego, California, who I haven't met him and I haven't talked to him, so I don't quite know why this happened. But I have this image in my head of this kid sitting on the surfboard waiting for the next wave, thinking, you know, if I had a laptop in my surfboard, I could be surfing the internet while I'm waiting to get on the, you know, catch a big wave going into the shore. So he built a laptop into his surfboard, and he put a Wi-Fi hotspot at the rescue shack. So now he sells this as a product. If you want to surf the internet while you're surfing the ocean, you can do that with this San Diego equipment. So I'm predicting that there are going to be literally billions of devices on the internet, probably a lot more devices than there are people. And if you think about this for just a moment, every single day you interact with a lot of appliances, things at home, ordinary household equipment, things at work, the printers, the projection units, your laptop and so on, and things in the car, and things that you carry around in your purse or hanging on your belt. So I would guess maybe there could be 10 or maybe even 100 things that you interact with that are on the network in addition to yourself. So there could be literally many billions of things on the net, which, by the way, motivates the need for IPv6. Some of the things you already see. When you walk into a hotel room, you see web TVs. You see the keyboard. Certainly you sometimes see video games, and those are online on the net. The kids that are playing the video games are talking to each other through the internet while they're playing the video game. There's even an internet-enabled washing machine, which is very popular in universities. Basically, what you put your clothes in the washing machine, and then you go off and have a beer, and it sends an SMS to you when your clothes are ready to move into the dryer. So the kids really like the convenience of just going off and enjoying themselves and being told when it's time to move their clothing from one place to another. There are lots of other possibilities here, and I don't have time to go into all of them, because there are other people who will be speaking today. But I do want to mention that sensor networks are also going to be a very popular part of the internet, and I'd like to show you one. This is an IPv6 radio-based sensor net that I'm running in my house. It's a commercial piece of equipment. It's not something I cobbled together in the basement. It's from a company called Archrock, and basically it measures the temperature and humidity and the light level of each room in the house every 5 minutes. And it collects that data. And I can use that to analyze how well the heating and ventilation and air conditioning system work in the house over a course of a year or more. So there are 12 sensors, and they're gathering this temperature and humidity data. This is showing you the kind of the connectivity. There are two routers and one device collecting all the data that I call Einstein, and it's down in my basement. This is a picture of what the little devices think of each other. They're radio-based. And they are signaling each other to let everybody know who can hear whom. So the system is self-organizing, and the routing of the traffic is based in part on what devices can hear which other devices. So they help each other get the data to the Einstein accumulating unit. All of the data is collected on a cumulative basis. And in fact, if we look in the most important room in the house, I have to tell you, is the wine cellar. Now, all the other rooms should be at about 70 to 75 degrees and maybe the humidity about 40 to 50%. The wine cellar needs to stay below 60 degrees Fahrenheit and above 70% humidity. Very important. Otherwise, the corks dry out and the wine goes bad. So the system is designed to alarm whenever the temperature goes above 60 degrees. And in fact, this happened about a month ago. I was at Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago, and my mobile went off. It was the wine cellar calling, telling me that the cooling system had quit and the temperature was rising. Well, I was stuck at Argonne National Laboratory for 3 days, and every hour on the hour, my mobile went off, telling me, you know, your wine is getting warmer and warmer. And my wife was away on a holiday in Russia, so she couldn't turn the thing on either. So what I need to do now is to outfit the system not only with the sensors, but an actuator, which it's capable of doing, so I can force the cooling system to go back on again. In the meantime, this kind of system has turned out to be quite useful for me. At least I'm aware of the fact that there's potential problems. You can get more detailed analysis. This is, for example, a 24-hour view of the wine cellar condition. You see variations in the humidity, not very much, around 80%, and variations in the light level and in temperature, which is ranging on the order of 58 degrees or so. One of the things that you can kind of tell by seeing what the light levels are is if somebody goes into the wine cellar and turns the lights on, I can tell that that's happened. What I can't tell is whether anything left the wine cellar without my permission. So some people have suggested I need to augment the system by putting RFID detectors RFID chips on the wine bottles and an RFID detector in the wine cellar so I can tell if a bottle is left. Someone pointed out to me that that's not enough either, because someone could go into the wine cellar and drink the wine and leave the bottle there and it's empty. So, you know, I need to now instrument the cork and so I can tell if there's anything inside the bottle. There's always work for engineers to do. Well, let me just quickly say that there are lots of changes coming to the Internet. This year and next year are probably the most significant years for Internet's evolution that I can remember since the beginning. V6, of course, going into the network, adding a new address space. We had a workshop yesterday on domain name system security, and many of you probably attended. Some of you probably even spoke about it. The idea here is to improve the assurance that when you do a domain name lookup and get back an IP address, it's the IP address that what was intended for you to get, as opposed to something that was modified by a hacker that poisoned the cache of a resolver or did some other interference. So by asking for a signed answer, you have some sense of the veracity or validity of the binding between the domain name and the IP address. So that's something that, in fact, again, Sweden has taken the lead. .se, the top-level domain here, was the first to implement DNSSEC and is exploring various kinds of applications in industry where it might be strongly useful to have these kinds of confirmed results, like in the banking industry, the financial sector, and things like that. In addition to that, the domain names are going to be augmented with non-Latin character sets. So things like Arabic and Cyrillic and Hebrew, Chinese and Japanese and Korean and so on, those languages and the character sets or scripts that represent them will become part of the domain name system's vocabulary for expressing domain names. This is a big change, because for the last 30 years, the only thing you could use was Latin characters and just the letters A through Z, digits 0 through 9, and a hyphen. So this is a big change for the domain name system. There are some risk factors associated with it. If you know something about Greek and Latin and Cyrillic, you'll know that many of the letters in those languages look exactly the same. But the computer coding for them is different. So it's possible to register a string which looks like it's all Latin characters, but some of them might be Cyrillic, for example, or Greek. And the computer will distinguish the two. So those would be distinct registrations, but the human being who looks at it doesn't know the difference. And if you click on a hyperlink with one of the, you know, an altered registration, you may end up at a website you weren't expecting to go to. So this is an issue that those of us who work on standardization are trying to cope with. And finally, the ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, is going to be permitting new top-level domains, both country codes, to be expressed in non-Latin characters, and new generic top-level domains also expressible in non-Latin characters. So this is a big change to the Internet's visible complexion. I don't have time to go into a lot of detail about security or research topics. I just want to reinforce the point that despite the fact the Internet's 30 years old, in design, or more than that, 35 years old, there is still a lot to be done to make the Internet more useful than it is today. We don't do broadcasts at all in the Internet very well. We do some approximation called multicast, but it hasn't been very popular. We don't make use of multi-homing. We don't make it easy for people to have more than one ISP and still have convenient services on an end-to-end basis where it doesn't matter which path is taken to carry our traffic. So we have lots of potential new designs to add to the internet to make it more functional and more effective than it is today. Security is a huge issue everywhere throughout the architecture of the system. Authenticity is a big problem. We don't know where email came from. We don't know which hosts we're talking to necessarily. We can build much stronger systems that will help us validate that. And we haven't yet. And so there's people, if there's anybody in the room looking for a PhD dissertation topic, there are several hiding in these charts. So let me just quickly mention a couple of other things, because I know that you want to get to the next speakers and some Q&A. First is that the internet is a real challenge for anyone who's concerned with intellectual property. The most common form of intellectual property is copyright. And the theory behind copyright is that if you have the rights to copy, then other people don't. And therefore, if they want copies, they have to come to you because you have the right to create, for example, physical instances of this work. It could be a book, it could be a DVD, it could be an audio or video tape. So these physical instances are the copies, and they're controlled. And that's how people are given compensation for the creation of intellectual property. Well, the internet comes along, and it completely wrecks that idea, because the World Wide Web, which is the principal application of the net, works by copying. Your browser goes to some other site on the internet and copies a file, and then it interprets it for presentation on your browser, so or on your laptop or desktop. So copying is fundamental to the way the internet works, and it's a big collision with the copyright world. The engineers and the legislators and the lawyers are going to have to learn or have to explore how to protect or how to compensate the creators of intellectual property while dealing with this fundamental collision between the notion of copyright and the way in which the internet tends to work. Another thing which I am worried about is that each of us who use complex pieces of software like spreadsheets or PowerPoint slides or other kinds of things like that are creating very, very complicated digital objects. You know, they're usually a file, and the file is full of bits. And the bits don't mean anything at all unless you have the application software to interpret them. So I want you to do a Gedanken experiment. Imagine that it's the year 3000, and you've just done a Google search, and you've turned up a 1997 PowerPoint file. Let's even imagine you're running Windows 3000. The question is, does it know how to interpret a 1,000-year-old PowerPoint file? And the answer is probably no. This is also, the answer would be no, even if this was open source. So the problem is, what do we do about these complicated objects that we keep creating and accumulating in the web or in the net over time? I worry that by the year 2100, software evolution will have continued, and that a lot of the information that will represent you and what you've done in the 21st century will be uninterpretable by our descendants. They will wonder about what we were doing and thinking, but they won't be able to figure it out because none of the software will be around that interprets the complicated objects that we've been creating and accumulating. I call this problem bit rot because it's as if we've accumulated all these files in the internet and then we don't know how to interpret them. So we have to figure out how to deal with that problem. One of the solutions may be that when someone says, I'm not supporting the software anymore, we could say, well, then you need to put it in the cloud. You need to put it in the net and make it accessible to people who are still using those files and need for them to be interpreted. Well, there will be some intellectual property issues associated with making that particular solution. So we need to work on this problem. Otherwise, what will happen over time is it will accumulate huge amounts of information in the internet and we won't be able to interpret it at all. So I want to finish with a very quick, if I could, update on an extension of the internet to operate across the solar system. Now, I've been talking about this for 10 years. The project was started at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in 1998, and the idea was basically to think about improving the networking capability for exploring the planets. So Mars is an example. We landed the Viking landers in 1976 on Mars, and we had point-to-point radio links, which were provided by the Deep Space Network. This is the big 70-meter dishes that are located at Canberra, Australia, Madrid, Spain, and Goldstone, California, talking to spacecraft that are in orbit around the planets or flying past the asteroids or maybe even landing on the surface like the rovers on Mars or the more recent Phoenix lander at the pole, North Pole of Mars. Most of the networking capability in the past has been point-to-point radio links with not a great deal of flexibility. My colleagues and I at the Jet Propulsion Lab would like to be able to have the space-faring nations, both doing manned and robotic missions, to have the same kind of rich networking capability that we have terrestrially with the Internet. And in fact, we even started out thinking that we could get away with using the standard Internet protocols. And we discovered in an hour and a half or so that this was not going to work. The first problem was that, the distance between the planets is literally astronomical. And when you look at the way things like TCP work, where there's, a kind of handshaking for flow control, between Earth and Mars, it can take as much as 20 minutes for a signal to propagate at the speed of light one way, and 40 minutes to get a round trip. So imagine that you're trying to do flow control using TCP with something that's on Mars. And you say, okay, don't send any more. I've run out of room. And it takes 20 minutes before the guy on the other end hears you say that. And, of course, he's transmitting data at maximum rate. The packets are falling all over the place. Doesn't work. Then there's this other problem. It's called celestial motion. The planets, most of them, have this annoying habit of rotating. And we don't seem to be able to do anything about it. So imagine you're talking to some rover on the surface of Mars, and after a while it disappears because the planet rotates and you can't talk to it. So the communications in space, especially interplanetary communications, is both disrupted frequently and it's also highly delayed. So as we started working on the problem and we recognized that we had to do something different from TCP/IP, we ended up with a protocol that we call a bundle protocol, which is a class of delay and disruption tolerant networking systems. So we've been developing these technologies for the last decade or so. We tested them here in Sweden, believe it or not, among the Sami, the reindeer herders, because they're way up in the north and their satellite communication doesn't work very well because the antennas are right down on the horizon. So we actually outfitted some all-terrain vehicles with laptops that are running our DTN protocols and put some hotspots in the villages. And as you drive into the village, you dump the data in or you pick up the data and then you go off and wander around and land in other villages. So it's like being a little data mule. You sort of show up, dump the data, pick up whatever you want. So that worked. So the DTN protocols were demonstrated to work well in this terrestrial environment. And over the weekend, we uploaded the DTN protocol implementation to a spacecraft called Deep Impact. It's actually been renamed Epoxy. The Deep Impact spacecraft was used to launch a probe into a comet about 2 years ago. It's in eccentric orbit around the sun right now, and it's still functional. It has radios and computers and solar panels. So we uploaded our protocols into this Deep Impact spacecraft, and literally as we speak, there's testing going on with that spacecraft to see whether the DTN protocols will perform as they're supposed to. In January, the plan is to upload the protocols to the International Space Station. And for a year, we're going to be able to do some testing of the new protocols on that spacecraft. By the way, when your Swedish astronaut goes up to the International Space Station in September of next year, in theory, we'll be able to communicate with him using the new interplanetary protocols. So that's the state of affairs. What we're hoping is that at the end of 2009, after all this testing, that we will space qualify the DTN protocols and we will be able to persuade not only the American NASA, but the European ESA and the Japanese JAXA and other spacefaring countries to adopt the use of these standard protocols for all of their space communications. If they do that, then what will happen over the period of decades during the course of this 21st century, every spacecraft that's launched will have compatibility with every other one, and any that are still in operation could be potentially repurposed in order to support new missions. And so the idea here is to grow an interplanetary backbone over a period of decades using these new standards. And that, Mr. Chairman, is all that I have for formal remarks this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity. I thank you for having me here, and I look forward to any questions that you might have now or at the end of all of our presentations. And I turn this back over to you. Okay. You need that back.
Vi tar frågorna efter alla tre talarna för att ha lite mer tid och inte ha för stora block. Så jag skulle jättegärna vilja be Åsa att börja med hennes anförande.
Tack för det.
Just det.
Om du tar min.
Tack för det, men nu hörs det. Men först skulle jag bara vilja säga att det är naturligtvis... It's an honor for us to have you, Dr. Windsurf, here with us today. Thank you very much for visiting us. And I hope you also excuse me for now switching on to Swedish. För varje dag som går blir det allt mer uppenbart att IT och internet får en större betydelse som drivkraft för utveckling och för tillväxt. Jag nämnde i fjol just detta med att internet redan idag är en bärare av många samhällsviktiga tjänster och en allt mer betydelsefull kommunikationskanal för oss alla. Medborgare, företag, offentlig sektor, ja, världen över. Och jag vidhåller därför att vi måste värna om den här öppenheten och tillgängligheten och att vi alla på olika sätt kan och ska bidra till detta. I en hel del stadsnät finns idag möjlighet att välja mellan flera olika internetleverantörer, vilket ger goda förutsättningar för konkurrens och valfrihet. Däremot så kanske jag också har hört några oroande signaler om att vi kanske inte alltid är på rätt väg. Jag vill slå vakt om öppenheten i nätet och jag vill att användarna så långt som möjligt också ska garanteras valfrihet, där de själva kan välja vilken typ av uppkoppling och tjänster som man vill ha. Därför är det viktigt att vi ständigt för en diskussion om öppenhet. Men jag vill också säga att det kan ju bli så att vi har ett intresse av att se över och undersöka vad som kan göras för att värna den här öppenheten i nätet. Och det är en diskussion som vi nu har på departementet. Internet idag är inte bara en fråga för civilingenjörer, utan en arena i stort sett för varenda sektor. På något sätt är vi alla påverkade av utvecklingen. Att kunna nå en kundkrets, oberoende av nationsgräns, möjlighet att kunna göra affärer, erbjuda tjänster och såklart naturligtvis också konsumera och kommunicera. Det i sig öppnar ständigt nya marknader. Det blir dessutom ännu viktigare när vi nu går in i en avmattning eller rent av en lågkonjunktur. EU undersökte år 2006 hur IT-investerarnas investeringar har påverkat den ekonomiska tillväxten i ett antal olika länder och kom fram till att IT-kapital under åren 1995-2004 har stått för 80% av Sveriges tillväxtökning. IT-investeringar har således varit en oerhört viktig värdeskapande komponent för Sverige under den här perioden. För vanliga företagare handlar det om att kunna skära i kostnader och kunna då möta upp med nya kunskaper för att nå nya kundgrupper på ett kostnadseffektivt sätt. För att ytterligare stärka Sveriges ställning på det här området så kommer det under veckan att överlämnas en forskning- och innovationsproposition till riksdagen. Och där i den anslås det ytterligare 125 miljoner för just IT-forskning och om IT och mobil kommunikation. Och just för att internetutveckling påverkar oss alla och alla sektorer så är det viktigt också att vi för en diskussion kring internet och dess utveckling. Om hur vi använder det som verktyg eller som kommunikationskanal. Internetdagarna är ju ett sådant forum. Och det är klart att ni som sitter här, representanter för olika sektorer och intressenter, är oerhört viktiga i det sammanhanget. Men det är också viktigt att vi tillsammans ser att vi har olika roller och olika ansvarsområden och att vi behöver bidra med insatser för att åstadkomma ett informationssamhälle där medborgare och företag känner delaktighet, kan bo och verka i städer lika väl som glesbygd och att vi har olika roller i det här uppdraget. För ett av våra mål är att alla i samhället ska ha tillgång till elektroniska tjänster var som helst. Och när som helst. Det är, som ni förstår, ett oerhört ambitiöst mål. Men vi vet att tillgänglighet och robust IT-infrastruktur är en nödvändighet och en förutsättning för just tillgången till internet. Vi ser också att denna tillgång idag är en grundläggande förutsättning för hållbar tillväxt, för sysselsättning, för företagande, för en effektiv förvaltning. Och för att förenkla vardagen för medborgare och företag generellt. Men jag tror det är också viktigt att vi förstår och ser de förändringar som har skett under de senaste åren. De senaste 15 åren så har vi gått naturligtvis från en ganska dramatisk utveckling från marknadsmässigt från, ja, i princip ett statligt monopol för telekomtjänster till en dynamisk konkurrensutsatt marknad. Detta har såklart varit positivt på många sätt. Sverige ligger ju internationellt sett bra till vad det gäller tillgång till elektronisk kommunikation av hög kvalitet. Vi har till exempel Ciscos rapport om Broadband Quality Index där vi kommer tvåa efter Japan. Vi har en stark utveckling vad det beträffar olika sätt att koppla upp sig, både trådbundna och trådlösa lösningar. För mig är det självklart att den här utvecklingen är bra, men att också att det i första hand är marknaden som ska tillhandahålla den. Vi kommer från statens sida ha en viktig roll genom att skapa goda förutsättningar just för att marknaden ska ta ansvar för detta. Det vi har gjort genom att effektiva lagen om elektroniska kommunikationer. En sak. Vi har infört möjlighet till funktionell separation likt brittiska telekommodellen. Och just nu arbetar Maud Olofsson med en proposition som ska begränsa kommuners offentliga verksamheter. Vilket naturligtvis i sig en tydlig signal till framförallt våra kommuner att inte då till exempel den kommunala stadsnäten går för högt upp i värdekedjan. Jag noterar också att ett av era pass här idag är under internetdagarna är ett miljötema. Och vi håller på att ta fram en handlingsplan för klimatanpassat informationssamhälle som kommer att vara ganska direkt på med praktiska tips för framförallt offentlig sektor. Hur man kan agera miljövänligt och energisnålt. Som en parentes kan man nämna att den planen stötte på patrull kanske från ett oväntat sätt ifrån vårt perspektiv i vart fall. Vår kära IT-enhet tyckte inte att datorerna skulle stängas av över natten eftersom det tydligen var ett sätt att rulla upp uppdateringarna. Sedan vi sågs här förra året har regeringen fattat ett beslut som jag tror, låt mig säga, eftervärlden kommer att bedöma som ett strategiskt väldigt avgörande och viktigt beslut. Efter den analoga tv-sändningarnas nedsläckning så har vi fördelat ett betydande utrymme av det övre UHF-bandet på mobila tjänster. Jag bedömer det som att det finns mycket god potential till att förse stora delar av vårt glest befolkade land med mobilt och snabbt bredband av den här anledningen. Men för att det ska bli möjligt så krävs det ju att fler länder faktiskt hänger på. Finland har redan gjort det. Och EU-kommissionär Redding har kommenterat vårt beslut i mycket, mycket positiva ordalag. Och det är ju också så att representant för broadcastingindustrin i Europa har klagat på att just vi har varit lite aggressiva i den här marknadsföringen. Så visst händer det saker. Men jag vill säga det, vi behöver hjälp. Om inte fler länder väljer att i enlighet med Sverige och i det här sammanhanget också Finland gå vidare, så kommer det vara tveksamt om industrin kommer att utveckla produkter för just det här frekvensbandet. Så med vädjan till er om att när ni har tillfälle att i era internationella kontakter och sammanhang sprida kunskap och information om vad vi har gjort i Sverige och vikten av att vi också går vidare med att använda frekvensbandet i enlighet med vad som faktiskt världsradiokonferensen 2007 sa, så skulle jag vara väldigt tacksam för er hjälp. Samtidigt ska vi då komma ihåg att mobila bredbandstjänster även förutsätter en bra infrastruktur. Ibland får man intrycket att mobilt bredband skulle kunna ersättas av det trådbundna. Vi kan inte heller blunda för att vi står inför stora utmaningar när vi blickar framåt. Både det privata och offentliga har tillsammans gjort stora insatser som bidragit till att IT-infrastruktur som står sig väl i internationellt perspektiv. Men när det gäller, här gäller det att hela tiden vara medveten om utvecklingen och hitta samarbetsformer och insatser som matchar de olika rollerna vi har. Här har vi från det offentliga sektorn ytterligare en viktig roll. Både som användare men naturligtvis som kravställare och kunniga beställare. Ett orosmoln som är på väg mot oss är i oroväckande hög hastighet är hur IP-adresserna håller på att ta slut. Jag vet att Patrik Fällström kommer att prata om det här och jag hoppas att användarna och marknaden själv skulle hantera detta. Det finns mycket som dock tyder på att inte så är fallet. Och det är inte acceptabelt att internet som kanske vår generations viktigaste innovationsredskap för demokrati och ekonomisk tillväxt ska begränsas på grund av att man kanske till och med kan uttrycka det som att man stoppar huvudet i sandet. Det gör ju dessutom extra tråkigt att konstatera att de nya växande internetländerna som riskerar att drabbas värst av bristen på IP-adresser. Och det är kanske just de här länderna som behöver ett fritt flöde av information, åsikter och demokrati. Precis det som vi förknippar med internet. Vi kan naturligtvis som offentlig aktör bidra genom att se till så att vi är bra offentliga upphandlare på det här området. Bra kravställare för att se till att de här produkterna och tjänsterna som vi köper har stöd i IPv6. Dessutom arbetar vi på ett europeiskt nivå för att stödja implementeringen utav IPv6. EU-kommissionen presenterade i juni en handlingsplan som bland annat uppmanar medlemsländerna att själva införa IPv6 i sina egna förvaltningars IT-infrastruktur. Det kommer också att genomföras kampanjer och ekonomiskt stöd för vissa särskilda åtgärder i syfte att just gynna övergången till nya protokollet och satsningar på utbildningsinsatser för de grupper som kan behöva det. Det här är en plan som Sverige naturligtvis stöder. Men det finns ju också andra, kanske mer jordnära, direkta problem som jag möter när jag åker runt omkring i landet. Och det är naturligtvis hushåll och företag som saknar bredband, men även telefoni. Staten har dock idag inte så stora möjligheter att peka med hela handen som vi kunde tidigare då Telia verkade på en marknad som inte var lika konkurrensutsatt. Vi är ett glest befolkat land och jag kan inte godta att vissa grupper eller områden hamnar utanför för att de inte har tillgång till IT och internet och därigenom de e-tjänster som finns och som jag ser växer fram. Vi måste möta den här utmaningen så vi kan klara av att säkerställa samhällsbehov av tillgängliga, robusta elektroniska kommunikationer och de kommer till att krävas i all högre grad. Men de här utmaningarna är gemensamma. Det betyder att lösningar kräver insatser såväl från de enskilda som företag och från de offentliga sidan för att vi ska kunna lyckas. Samtidigt så vill jag återigen, som jag sa tidigare, det är viktigt att komma ihåg att vi har olika roller. Jag vill framhålla att det är inte vi politiker som ska styra marknaden eller heller inte kan styra den tekniska utvecklingen. Utgångspunkten är att elektroniska kommunikationstjänster och infrastruktur tillhandahålls av marknaden. Vår uppgift är att skapa goda förutsättningar, formulera politiska mål och undanröja hinder för utveckling. Bland annat genom att verka för att det finns en bra, relevant reglering som ger alla aktörer möjlighet att agera på lika villkor. Här är det också viktigt att vi måste ha en helhetssyn kring alla typer av regleringar där internet och elektroniskt påverkar eller påverkas. Det här kräver kunskap och kompetens och här tror jag också att vi måste bli bättre. Det vi också måste förstå är att hela marknaden är i ständig förändring och utveckling och att internetutvecklingen är en del av detta. I en sån föränderlig miljö bör vi värdera och se över vilken roll som staten ska ha. Men hur vi samtidigt bidrar till just kontinuitet och långsiktighet. Till exempel så har jag valt att hantera frågan om IT-infrastruktur i ett sammanhang genom att de båda utredningarna, Bredband 2013 och Frekvensutredningen, som inte kom exakt i parallella tidsperspektiv, men att vi hanterar de två utredningarna tillsammans just för att kunna möta ökat behov och ökad krav på tillgänglighet och hög kapacitet i alla dess delar av landet. I det arbetet så ingår det för mig också att se hur det offentliga och privata kan samverka. Det är viktigt att få en fungerande konkurrens. Vi politiker ska inte styra med åtgärder. Jag tror inte på socialism i någon form. Inte ens när det handlar om bredband. Samtidigt så vet jag att det finns brister. Och det kommer att vara en utmaning för oss. Men för mig är det intressant att finna nya former för samverkan för att vi ska skapa bra förutsättningar för bredband och hög kapacitet i alla dess delar av landet. Jag tror det är viktigt också att vi strävar mot samma mål just för att vi vet att vi har olika åtaganden. Men för att nå dit så krävs det dialog mellan oss och olika intressenter emellan. Och det är ett arbete som jag vill värna och det är ett arbete som vi har framför oss. Tack för att ni lyssnade.
So let's see how this works. Oops. Just like Vint, I'm a Mac user, just like some of you know, so let's see whether I can find the presentation. There. So, Patrick Feldström is My name, as some of you know. Jeff Houston was the one that was invited to have this presentation, but unfortunately he is sick and cannot come. So instead, I offered myself having this presentation because this is a topic which Jeff and I have been working quite a lot on. And so what you will see here is a merge between Jeff's slides and my ideas. Of course, I was the one that edited the last version of this presentation, so we'll see what happens. So don't blame just me or just Jeff. It's some kind of continuous effort. So anyway, so the whole idea is that we're going to do this kind of like discussion about IPv6. What is really happening here? But on the other hand, you have seen quite a large number of like presentations regarding IPv6. And you probably have seen some of these presentations that either Jeff or myself has had. So the only question is like, how tiresome will this be? Is it possible to say something like something new about this? How dangerous is this? You heard both Vint and then also Åsa saying and recognizing that we actually have some problem here. Because we have been working on IPv6 for quite some time. The market has tried, the market's promised the ministers and the governments in the world to actually do something and deploy IPv6, but not enough has happened. So what I will try to talk about here is the failure of IPv6. What will the consequences be? And I'll tell you, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good for many different kind of reasons, and I will try to mention some of them. And yes, the idea is to scare you a little bit, but not only scare, but also I hope that you all remember what Åsa talked about, the need to work together, the need for everyone in the society to actually do whatever is part of our role, what we are responsible for. So if we look at the situation for IPv4 today, you see that the number of IPv4 addresses that we have left is decreasing, and it's decreasing fast. And of course, each one of you might have IP addresses, and each person and each party that have been running internet for more than 5 years, of course, they have enough IP addresses, they think. But each one of us will one day connect one single device, and at that point in time, you don't have that one IPv4 address that you want to add. What do you do? You only have very few options. One option is, of course, to not add that device, but of course, it might be that very wine bottle that you actually would like to monitor. So that would be a little bit tragic. The other option is to start to use IPv6 at that point in time. But if you want to add the device, you might have like 30 minutes to actually add it, and you don't really add IPv6 to your network in that short period of time. It might be to add another NAT device, et cetera, et cetera. But you will panic. I promise you, you will panic. And because of that, it's so important that we actually do more. Now, I do know, of course, that specifically in Sweden, the last 8 months, there have been a very big difference. I claim that 1 year ago, people that tried and wanted to run IPv6, they could say, no, I would like to run IPv6, but I cannot buy it from the ISPs. And because of that, many people didn't do anything. Today, I claim that in Sweden, we have a completely different situation. The ISPs do have IPv6 today. So all of you out there that have been sitting, leaning back, not doing anything because you think that IPv6 doesn't exist as a product, there is something you should do. So how bad is this situation? Well, if we look at the number of addresses we have, you have seen these kind of graphs. Like, so this is what it looks like. We see that, the picture from the Vint showed as well, that we are running out of addresses at some point in time, etc. So at the moment, it looks like the 15th of November 2010. That's when you cannot get any more IPv4 addresses. Of course, it's really important to remember that just because we reach this date, whatever date it is, the IPv4 network will not stop running. Everything that already have an IPv4 address will continue to run just fine. But the question is then, what do we do? But on the other hand, you've seen this kind of presentation a couple of times, so this is kind of boring. So, okay. So we are reaching this date. And the date is actually coming closer and closer to where we are. So we are moving towards the date, and the date moves towards us. It doesn't look good. So it could be as much as 18 months until we actually run out of addresses. But it's very, very problematic to model when we are running out just because of panic, that some people understand that I might not be able to get the IPv4 addresses, so I will do a request now instead of waiting. So we might have a last minute land rush for IPv4 addresses, which means that it will run out much, much faster. It might be the case that we'll have some new policies coming from the RIRs that will actually allocate and save some of the address space, so all the address space we think that you can request will not be available. It might also be the case that just because people are starting to run IPv6 and various other kind of things, it might be the case that the need for IPv4 and request for IPv4 space will also differ. So it's really, really hard to know what's actually happening. But let's say that we are talking about a point in time sometime between 2009 and 2011. And late 2009, that's 1 year from now. And let me now do a check here. Every one of you that actually do have IPv6 where you normally work or where you use a computer, please raise your hand. Okay, you can look around here and you see that it's approximately, like I say, 10%. So we have 10% of the people in this room use IPv6, and 1 year from now it might be the case that the rest of you cannot get any new IPv4 addresses. So, what will happen? Well, IPv6, the new shiny train. Okay, so we had this plan that the size of the internet is growing, we get the IPv6 deployment up, and the number of IPv4 addresses go down. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. This is what it looks like. The IPv4 pool size goes down, the size of the internet grows, but the adoption of IPv6 does not go up. So what do we do? So it's time to move. This is what everyone has told you. This is what I have told you. This is what Jeff has told you. This is what Vint has told you. This is what Ors has told you. Are people moving? Like, not really. But plan A is that everyone is adopting IPv6. Everything ends up being sort of dual stack and reachable before January 2009. 2 months ahead. Okay, 2 months to go. Completely quits using IPv4 because, as Vint explained, if you have something on IPv6, you can only communicate with other things on IPv6. So, of course, we need to stop using IPv4. And we have to do this well before we don't have an IPv4 address anymore. So do you think this is possible to do in 2 months? Okay, not really. So the idea that someone told everyone in this room and in the world, you have to start use IPv6, didn't work. It didn't even help that Vint came here and, like, and other people came here and said, okay. But if it now is the case that we are using this, following this plan A, this means that we have to deploy IPv6 within 60 days and then within the next 10 days stop use IPv4. Okay. Do you really think this is possible? The problem here is that a big change and a fast change doesn't go really well together. Specifically, it will not work out really well. So it doesn't look really good. So plan B is to use something called dual stack. We start using IPv6 and IPv4 at the same time. We grow IPv6 deployment slowly, and we persist using IPv4 networks, and we use address translation boxes, NATs, carrier-grade NATs, and the whole nine yards that everyone is talking about. We will make IPv4 work by using even more NATs. We have the ISPs deploying NAT boxes, et cetera, et cetera. We'll have new products that from various different kind of vendors that is doing this address translation. We get application layer gateways. This will take some time. Like at Cisco, we deployed our first IPv6 node around 1995. That's like 12 years ago. When I talked to, we responded to a survey that we got from an organization. So how is it going with IPv6 deployment? And the first question was, when did you start to deploy? And you had a number of options, 2001, 2004, 2005, and then other. And it was like 1995, okay? They didn't have that as an option. So how long do you think you will work on deploying IPv6? It was like one more year, blah, 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 blah. And our IT guy said 10 more years. This will take time. So if it is the case that we're using IPv4 for another 10 to 20 years, what is the role of IPv6? What immediate benefit do you get by deploying IPv6 and dual stack? Not much. So this doesn't really look good. Why do you want to deploy IPv6? Is it just to see the animated logo of Google? You get the same result back, right? So you can still use IPv4 as long as you have the IPv4 address. So why are we here? Well, the whole network that we have is funded by customers. Every vendor is focused on meeting the needs of the customers, and the customers have absolutely no clue what IPv6 is. They buy the broadband connection to access Google, and they will access Google regardless of whether they're using IPv4 or IPv6. So how come then, and how do we manage to get deployment of IPv6 without having anyone paying for it? And this is like the business model just doesn't work. Okay. So one question, of course, is if IPv6 or the introduction of a new protocol is actually a business failure. Is this something, an invention that businesses and the market came up with that in reality, yes, technically look good, but the business model is completely wedged? So no one really wants to take the cost. But of course, there are some other options to IPv6. But what options are there? So if we don't get IPv6, what will happen? Well, the existing network for IPv4 will, of course, continue to work. New networks have to use IPv4 because we don't have any other protocol. So no change there. So we have to make sure that IPv4 continue to work even though we run out of addresses. So we have to use address translation, gateways, and other kind of things. So plan C, IPv4 forever, means that we are not doing this slow deployment of IPv6. We are persisting to use IPv4 networks using more address translation gateways. So how do we do this? Do we redeploy IPv4 addresses? We can do that in a couple of ways. We can not, because not every address in IPv4 space is in use. So we might be the case that each one of you that have a block of IPv4 addresses, you actually have to renumber and make sure that you actually use each one of them. Each one of you which do IP address planning, know that that is not very fun. First of all, renumbering is not fun, and making sure that you actually use every IPv4 address you have is not fun either. So we could do something about utilization, but this also only buys us a little bit of time. So can we get some more addresses into circulation? Absolutely. But it will take money. It will take quite a large effort, and the question is whether the effort is not larger than actually deploy IPv6. And it only buys us time. The other thing we can do, of course, is to do even more address translations. I saw on the sensor network that you had, Vint, you used 10/8 network for the IPv4 address to access this IPv6 network. And this means that when you are accessing these sensors when being on the road, on the application layer, you actually use at least two address translation gateways, one from the public internet to your private IPv4 space, and then into IPv6. Okay. So, of course, each one of you that run NATs, of course, one NAT, no problem at all, as long as you know in what direction the traffic goes, et cetera, et cetera. Two NATs in a flow sort of works. We sort of know how to do this. Three. Okay. Four. Okay. Where each one of you that actually run NATs and stuff, where is the pain level? Is that at 1, 3, or 15? Okay, the answer is not high enough. Okay. So the question is, of course, then, how far can that scale? It only buys us time. How complex will the network be? Like, enormously complex. Do we really want to try this? And by the way, if it is the case that we use nets, as all of us know here, a net implies by default that you only can run traffic in one direction. So if it is the case that we deploy nets, then we will, as the market, have problem reaching the goals that Åsa just talked about, that everything should be reachable from anywhere. So you have to fulfill the request and the interest, the political interest, that everyone should be able to access anything from anywhere and still deploy nets. This is actually really a tough challenge. So we also know that using IPv4, you need like an enormous number of port numbers. Each NAT can serve like IP address about 200 hosts. The scaling is not very good. People, of course, in the ITF is talking about carrier-grade NATs, and sure, there are probably like people that would like to make money on this, but it doesn't look really good. So if it is the case that we have a /16, just as one example of IPv4, it can serve about 600 million customers if you get 100% packing density with NATs. You heard Vin talking about adding another billion users. So we actually need quite a large number of IPv4 address space just to serve the NAT boxes. So we have like a scaling problem. Can we scale this to serve 1 billion customers on an IPv4, on a /8 of IPv4 space? So sure, we could actually, with a pool of, with 4/8s, it might be the case that we can buy another 10 years. But then what do we do? And what do we do after the next 10 years? So this is not good either. So maybe it is the case that this interest of actually being able to reach services from wherever we are is wrong. Maybe it's not possible to do with the internet. Maybe this is the end of the experiment that Vin started in 1977. Did you hear what I just said? Is this the end to the internet? Not really, because there are many standards organizations in the world that think that, sure, we can invent new standards that do application layer gateway instead, and we have some really nice ones from, like, for example, IMS, we have IPX protocol, we have other things that is coming from 3G standards, for example, completely walled garden with application layer gateways, where you need to contract an agreement between you and your service provider on what services you want to have gatewayed. So just because you're not using IP level end-to-end, of course you don't need global addressing either. But how do you really address the boxes? Well, using domain names and other kind of things. So IMS is one thing. But on the other hand, if you look at the actual design of IMS, if you build something like an IP end-to-end network, it has fewer boxes. And, of course, people selling boxes think this is a good thing. You can make money. But how efficient will it be? What will the round-trip time be? Maybe we need to run the interplanetary protocol even on Earth just because the round-trip time is too high. So IPX, the brand new standard, doesn't look better. Okay. So maybe it is the case with the network architecture that is wrong here. We're talking about end-to-end IP address allocation, but on the other hand, maybe it is the case that end users, as we heard, people are only interested in being able to reach Google. They're only interested in actually reaching the services. So just by using some more interesting, more intelligent identity management, it's possible to actually build some overlay networking. And of course, sure, IMS and IPX is like part of that. But and you can also say that, like, if you use things like Skype and BitTorrent and peer-to-peer networks, the addressing is not really IP-based, and the end user doesn't care. So the whole architecture is actually pretty weird here, but the fundamental idea behind the internet is still that we have end-to-end IP address allocation. So, not really good. So I still think it is the case that you understand, and many of us, and I've been thinking about this, and Jeff have been thinking about this even more, that the only path forward is actually to deploy IPv6. Because all the alternatives are much, much worse. On the other hand, there are business models out there on the market for companies and organizations that do not want to see end-to-end communication. They don't want to see IPv6 work. They want to see a walled garden internet where we don't have any end-to-end. So it's not the case that the market sort of like agree on what the future model is. And that's why I think, because I personally and Cisco, we believe in the end-to-end model. And that's why we think it's, and I think it's good to hear that OSAN for growth of the internet and politicians in the world, they say that end-to-end is important. You should be able to pay your taxes regardless of where you are. You should be able to reach your email regardless of where you are. And for competition reasons, it's really important to actually be able to choose what services you do. But it ends up being a little bit problematic, because if you run your internet and if you buy a broadband connection, you buy service from someone, you have a fiber from a third company, and you have your wireless from the fourth one, you buy boxes from a fifth one, you try to call your friend, you don't get dial tone for those people who remember what dial tone was. The question is, who do you call? It's an extremely complicated situation for the consumer to know actually what the actual whose fault it is when something is not working. So unfortunately, what Jeff and I see is that short-term business interests, they are really driving the model of how internet is built today, and that is not escalation of the amount of end-to-end that is deployed in the world. Short-term business interests is very much today delaying the deployment of IPv6. Long-term, everyone agreed that IPv6 is a solution, of course. So if it is the case that we really want IPv6 to happen, I think everyone in this room that does not have IPv6 yet, all the manufacturers, all the procurers, public sector as well as private, really need to have a big kick in the butt. Because this is hard. We need to do this, but all the alternatives looks really, really bad. And because of that, I also, oops, what happened there? So that is also one of the reasons why I think it's good to hear what OSA said, that also like public sector is also helping, which I hope will happen. So deployment of IPv6 is still the best path forward, and I think, and Jeff thinks, that is definitely the lowest risk. So the problem, though, is that what we see is the short-term business interest is destroying this model. So we actually do think that there is a need for a regulative push to actually keep the network open. And we are definitely not talking about the need for, like, new regulation, IPv6-related regulation. We're talking about just applying normal competition rules. Is there an efficient competition? Or do we have the market lock-in or lock-out situations? We do have the tools in the Electronic Communication Directive in Europe regarding identifying dominant market players, just like what happened on the copper network in the UK and also in Sweden. But what about the fiber network? Is the regulation we have technology neutral enough? Don't really know. But it's really important that we actually do something, and we need help, we as the market, everyone in the room, public sector as well as private. I think we need to help each other. We need to kick each other in the butt to actually do something here. Thank you very much.
Fungerar det? Hör ni mig? Bra, då fick vi den andra också igång. Jag vill tacka alla tre talare. Vi har några minuter kvar för frågor. Finns det frågor i salen? Skulle det behövas? Är det någon som har en fråga? Ja, jag kommer att behöva den där.
Yeah, we can share these. This should work. That works.
Yep. Funkar den? Den är det.
Nej, jag är helt med på vad talarna har sagt. Men jag vill understryka att man måste komma ihåg att internet har en ideologisk bakgrund. Det får man inte glömma bort. Det är den ekonomiska och politiska makten som senare har ställt anspråk på inflytande över internet. Jag skulle väldigt gärna se att den politiska makten ställer upp på den ideologiska grunden. Internets organisationer måste få politiskt stöd. Det är inte marknaden som ska stödas, utan det är den ideologiska grunden. Och det är för att värna och slå vakt om internets oberoende. Internet är oberoende av leverantörer, oberoende av politik. Det ska man komma ihåg. Och jag skulle väldigt gärna säga att både den ekonomiska makten och den politiska makten ställde upp på det. Det är det jag vill säga.
Okej, det var inte så mycket en fråga. Men tack. Finns det flera frågor? Inga frågor. Då har vi lite praktisk information som kommer.
Just a second. Det här skulle jag ha gjort tidigare. Sorry. Vi gör så här. Hej, Lennart Bonnevier. Det är jag som är konferensarrangör här. Jag har egentligen bara två viktiga upplysningar. Det ena är att för de av er som tänkte vara med på middagen ikväll så är den flyttad från restaurang Aladdin till kabaré. Det är fortfarande i Folkets hus och vi kommer att skylta så ni hittar dit. Inga problem. Det andra är att de fem spåren som vi kör nu framöver under konferensen kommer att vara i följande lokaler. IP- och nätverksspåret är här i kongresshall A, som är den delen av hallen. Medan säkerhetsspåret kör i kongresshall B, som är den här delen. Vi ska dra fram en vägg här. Infrastruktur, samhälle, seminarierna är i kongresshall C. Domännamn i rum 307 som ligger en trappa upp. Och sist men absolut inte minst, webb och mobilitet håller till i rum 204 som är en halv trappa ner från den här våningen. Det och sen att toaletter finns i ganska stor utsträckning nere i utställningshallarna som ligger en trappa ner. Det finns några på den här våningen också, men de flesta ligger en trappa ner. Det kan man bra veta. Tack för mig.